This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review some issues from my comic book collection, which at times in the past, I used to select at random. Any books from my comic book collection are eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for them. Were the issues worth 25 cents? Were they bargains at 25 cents? Or were they still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 159th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we're looking at Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan the Warrior, 3, 4, and 5 from Malibu Comics, cover dated June 24th, August 12th, and September 4th, 1992. Like we said last episode, the inside covers of these issues contain actual release dates, not just months. But first, a little feedback. And we start with the correction that Billy D made. Good episode, Professor. One note, ERB didn't create Red Sonja, Robert E. Howard did. Otherwise, flawless as usual. First things first. I don't recall off the top of my head what Billy's profession is, what he does for a living, but the way that he slid that correction of a major flub on my part, and the way he put it in between two positive comments, you need to be in management, buddy. That was impressive. And thank you. I appreciate that correction. Billy added that he is a huge REH fan and considered my comment borderline blasphemy. But since we're both European soccer fans and I support the right team in North London, come on you Gunners, he agreed to let it slide with no more punishment. Actually, it's funny, I didn't mention it in that episode, but I thought about it and that is that REH and ERB do occasionally get confuzzled in my mind when it gets to especially the subsidiary characters. And actually, in terms of comics, I basically treat these two the same, or at least here are their main characters, Tarzan and Conan. I treat them the same, which is that for these characters in particular, I just don't care about continuity or reading order. If I find any Tarzan or Conan book or Savage Sword magazine or even John Carter, for that matter, any publisher, any era, it'll catch my eye. And if I don't recognize the cover, I'll strongly consider buying it, as opposed to the many, many other characters that I haven't started because their character histories or publishing histories can be quite convoluted and in some ways intimidating. But Tarzan and Conan, that doesn't even cross my mind. And shoot, I'm not looking at it right now. I didn't put it in these notes. But somebody, actually, technically speaking, corrected Billy because the Red Sonja from the comic book was created by Roy Thomas as opposed to the Red Sonja in the Robert E. Howard story. And you can tell because one is Sonja with a Y and one is Sonja with a J. And they are technically different characters. Technically, wink, wink. Luke Giaconetti, Sir Luke, commented, "Great episode, Professor. I've read a lot of Tarzan and other ERB comics, but never this series. Looking forward to hearing the conclusion for sure." One thing, you asked if Marvel's John Carter of Mars was the first time a Tarzan comics licensor picked up all of the ERB properties. I wanted to add that DC did do strips for John Carter, Pellucidar, and Carson of Venus during their time as licensor. Most of these were featured in the Weird Worlds title, as well as some backups in the pages of Tarzan Family. Stay thrifty, Professor. I love that sign-off. And you know, I've read some of those Tarzan Family issues with those stories in them completely slipped my mind. Thank you for that refresher. Chris Ouellette talked about his history with Tarzan. I've never read a Tarzan comic, but I like the first three of the novels, maybe four. But around book four or five, I realized that Edgar Rice Burroughs was no longer developing new ideas, but just playing out a formula that worked over and over. I haven't gotten that far yet, Chris, but being a fan of a number of novel series, that would not surprise me. That does tend to happen. Social media love for that last episode came from Laurel, aka Mountain Flower, from the Huntress podcast, Gene Hendricks from Two True Freaks, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Chris Lydon, Vic and Phoenix, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, Sir I Was Joe, Seth Tucker, Derek William Crabb, that fan hole, James Williams, Tim Price, the Pod Crasher, and our listeners of the year, the kind and lovely Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. So let's take a break here, play a promo, and when we get back, we'll be looking at Tarzan the Warrior 3, 4, and 5.
The Justice League wouldn't help him, so Batman formed a new team. These people of power are all looking for something, be it their past, or a purpose, or simply somewhere to fit in. These are the heroes for a troubled age. They are the Outsiders.
We are the Outsiders!
Covering Mike W. Barr's 1983 series from the very beginning, as they face villains no other team can, like Agent Orange, the Force of July, and the Nuclear Family. Puns. This is The Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast. Look for us with The Huntress podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Or listen at our website, thehuntresspodcast.com, and follow us on Twitter at @BatOutcasters. We are the Outcasters, because to live outside the law, you must be honest.
We are the Outsiders!
Speaking of Tim Price, yep, the Pod Crasher's all growed up and out doing his own thing now. The Outcasters, a new podcast with Ashford. So if you like the 1980s, check that one out. Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan the Warrior 3, 4, and 5 each had cover prices of $2.50. So you would think that at a quarter, that would work out to a very easy to compute 90% discount. Except, and don't panic, this is not another rule-breaking episode. We went over this last time, but let me explain it again. I pick these books up from Pulp Reality from their sit-down 50-cent bins. But here's the key. All five of these books were filed together in one extra-large bag. And the guy at the front desk, he just kind of shrugged and charged me 50 cents for all five books, which makes these dime comics. So I got a 96% markdown off that original retail price. Boom. All three of these covers were by Mark Hempel. All of the stories, which are just called Part 3, Part 4, and Part 5, were by Mark Wheatley with art by Neil Vokes and Mark Hempel. The cover of Issue 3 shows Jane, naked except for the blonde hair and towel, in the snow, scurrying back from a huge cat beast of some kind. John slash Tarzan is in the background running through the snow to come to her aid. Now, this specific scene, exactly like this, does not appear in the comic, but all of the separate elements do. The beast, the snow, and even Jane in a towel. Issue 3 starts in Earth's sister dimension, now referred to as Kal-Dan. They're in the extreme northern latitudes. That's where the snow comes in, and there's a lot of it. We get Jane's diary entries as narration boxes, following that same format that we saw last time. I should learn. It's always the same. When I'm following John, I'm following the beast, and I become lost. As John, shirtless because Tarzan, bursts through a snowbank to protect her and her alien ally, Wamcha, we read, "He is the beast, and God help me, I love him. His courage, his ability to love." The beasts who were attacking were the shapeshifters, and even when they take the form of John's animal friends, the Mangini, he does not hesitate to kill one of them to protect Jane. And then, a strange thing happens, which Wamcha explains as part of their process for choosing a new leader, and they've just chosen John. All of the shapeshifters shift their shape so they look just like him. "They won't listen to me," their green friend explains, "but now they'll do whatever you say." Before our team can find a new rift, a native of this land, a huge ape-like beast in a simple cloak and a crown, arrives with an entourage. Seeing that John has killed what he calls, quote, a slave, unquote, this being, this king, hires John as a trainer for his son in the art of fighting. Over Jane's objections, he agrees, meaning they need to stay in this wasteland for a time, which was Jane's main objection. Tarzan's main objection, on the other hand, is the shapeshifters under his command. "Could you please have them turn themselves into anything except me?" Here, we get Jane taking a warm water bath, with a servant keeping the water coming. She and Wamcha talk about servants and slaves, and the alien is shocked that where they come from, they don't have slaves. They debate whether the shapeshifter's pledge of loyalty and fealty to John constitutes slavery, an idea that he dismisses out of hand. And then while John trains the young prince, the ladies hear tribal legends of portals to other worlds. But the ape king dismisses it all as superstition. Women and slaves will believe everything. Meanwhile, in our world, the elderly Lord Greystoke escapes his confinement in what I take to be probably North Africa to call the authorities. But he is caught, and the mastermind behind his kidnapping and all of this is revealed as a young-looking, long-haired man in a suit, a man who looks a lot like John, a lot like our Tarzan. He then mentions characters from the Burroughs novels, revealing himself as the son of Olga Rokoff and Lord Greystoke. "You," he says to the old man, "are my father." So we have two generations of Tarzans revealed here, and we still need to figure out how our main character fits into this family tree. Speaking of him, speaking of John, the ape tribe is celebrating a recent conquest with a dum-dum, a type of celebration that features heavily in the Tarzan mythos and novels. And when the king brags about the new slaves that this conquest has brought him, Tarzan breaks. As Jane writes, "We have our differences, John and I. He's the beast, and I'm civilization. But when it comes to love and compassion, all our differences fade away. John sets the king's slaves free." And the king, he ain't happy about this. "He will pay with his life. The end of issue 3. The cover of issue 4 shows Tarzan front and center leaping, or possibly falling, into a pit, Jane and Womcha behind him. It's an action scene, that's for sure. And the oranges and yellows against a blue sky is certainly an uncommon look for comics. It is bold and attention-getting. Issue 4 starts right where issue 3 lets off, with the king demanding his troops to bring back the slaves, bring back the traitors. Again, Jane's words set the scene. This is a hideous travesty of reality, and John and I are trapped in it. I am in danger of losing myself. None of this seems real, and I feel as if I'm floating away from my emotions and from my love for John. As I grow more anxious to return to a recognizable reality, John sinks deeper into the cycle of aggressive male power fantasies. What was I thinking when I married this man? She doesn't use the word toxic because it was 1992, but you can see what she's getting at in our modern lingo. But then she adds, it's not because I get a kick out of being hauled through one adventure after another. A little bit of the fantastic goes a long way with me, so it must be love. As they flee the attack and seek a portal to jump through, Jane noodles on civilization and savagery and the thin veneer between the two. For her part, Womcha also wonders what she ever did to deserve this. At the edge of the rift, the ape tribe and the freed slaves and the shapeshifters debate slavery themselves, and the ape king has a change of heart. Let the slaves go. Let them all go. I'm not a warden. I was taught to be a warrior. And we're led to understand that clearly this is John's influence on the ape king. Having solved the tribe's problem, our heroes and the shape-shifting troops make the leap into the next dimension. Over in Africa, the Greystoke men find the remains of the family plantation. The younger of them, I should clarify and say the younger appearing of them, who goes by Mr. Hunt, chastises his father for never calling him his son as they look for the remains of the immortality serum that has kept them alive for so long. We get a little backstory on that, in addition to a reference to another Burroughs novel, Tarzan and the Golden Lion, which I have a copy of, but have not read yet. It's maybe 7th or 8th in the chronology. The comic book addresses whether what really happened was like the novel, or whether liberties were taken to protect the secret. I like that in this universe, the Tarzan books exist. They were written by Burroughs, and they are a thing. In the rift between worlds, Jane's toes wiggle, her skin crawls. They land on a planet, one inhabited by Womcha's people, but they doubt they can easily find the home dimension of Jane and John. Again, John manages to convince the troopers on the ship to not rebel and to follow him. I taught them songs, he explains. Now please get them to stop looking like me. Some running gags don't work, but I'm enjoying that one, that these shapeshifters turn themselves into clones of Tarzan, of John, when they accept his leadership. Womcha offers to take the couple back to her home world, from which they can look for the right rift, the right dimension to get back home. No thanks, John says. We'll stay right here. Jane pulls him aside for a heart-to-heart. Stay here? Are you crazy? If there's the slightest chance of finding home, I'm taking it. John thinks his natural rift-finding ability is all the help they'll need. He rhapsodizes about how long it's been since he's found a world like this one. Apes are my people. I was raised in their society. He explains. This is our eternal conflict, John. I can't exist without at least a hope of finding my home and friends again. I'm going with the ship when it leaves. Jane, he calls out after her as she walks away. The end of issue 4. The cover of issue 5 is mostly green, with some yellow here and there, and shows an extreme close-up of kind of a snarling-looking face, one that is certainly a bit Joker-like. It could be John, but it's probably that younger guy, the bad guy, the kidnapper guy, Mr. Hunt. Issue 5 starts with Jane in a starship from Womchaw's people above their home planet. A crew is looking for the right world. Still, nothing. I've been keeping these journals for so many years. At times, they're my only contact with any world I could recognize as real. On the surface, Tarzan, aka John, is leading the ape-like animal tribe, and he looks happy. He's also looking for home, using his own natural abilities. From the ship, they see that John is now interacting with a huge rift. It is so large that it could leap anywhere. And if he leaps in, will Jane, with or without Womcha and her people, will they follow? In Africa, the two other Tarzans, the elderly Lord Greystoke and the young Mr. Hunt, are trying to get to a particular plateau. Above that plateau, a rift opens and the spaceship appears. The pilot, one of Womcha's race, tells Jane that this is definitely her home world. She's pleased, but the fact that it's over Africa does not exactly fill her with joy. But John is ready for this, and the couple is glad to be home. They say goodbye to Womcha and the troopers and her people as they fly their ship away. From Jane's journal, we get another reason for the journals, I suppose, is to remember the places and the people. The pages of my journal may be the only place I'll ever see them again. But even though they are home, and they think the adventure is over, it's not. Not quite. Not yet. They see, from a distance, the other two Greystokes, their camp. And then it all comes together. Recognize anybody? Jane asks, handing the binoculars to Tarzan. That's our grandson down there. Eventually, the two younger-looking relatives meet. This is John, the OG Tarzan who we've been following, and his grandson, although they appear the same age. The men call you Hunt, John says, but I remember your name as being Jean-Raoul Decoud. The Decoud family, please forgive my horrible pronunciation of the French. But the Decoud is also from the novels. They worked with Darnaud and Rokoff in at least the early Tarzan novels. They argue about whether Hunt is John's son, about whether John and Olga Decoud ever, well, you know. But then Mr. Hunt also thought that the old man was Tarzan, so his assumptions have never been quite perfectly accurate, even though the kid is now running Greystoke Incorporated. They battle, like physically, literally battle, and they talk about psychology and being raised without parents, and they fight some more. And the young guy goes off a cliff, and I don't think he's around anymore. I was proud, Tarzan admits to himself, too proud to say it. True or not, I'm sorry for both of us. In the last few pages, John and Jane head for that other camp, and we see images of the jungle and of apes. From her journal again. For almost a century, John and I have been a family. We had children, and our children have had children. A century, such a time. From steam to atomic power. From pencil and paper to computer. We've watched the world grow ever smaller, transformed, overrun, allowed to fade away. Maybe we've just lived too long. Maybe we're just relics. At this point, on the last page, John and Jane rescue the old man, who recognizes them.
Grandfather, grandmother, thank heavens you showed up. That man was simply out of his mind.
Funny thing, though, the old man says. He's actually is their grandchild because, you know, science fiction, so he's the grandchild, but he's the one who looks like an old man. He says,
don't know if you noticed, but that other man sure looked a lot like you.
And we close appropriately with more of Jane's words. Yet I still feel young, and I believe no matter how long we live, it will never be enough. The end. A few notes. I was very confused the first time I read this series, and you may well be confused right now. I'm still probably 5% confused. In terms of figuring out who was related to whom, partly because the youngest of our three Greystokes, he's the one who appears as the old man, he's the grandson, and the oldest and the middle, the grandfather and the middle, they look just like each other. And it wasn't really until going through it again more slowly for the notes for this that I actually put it together that the guy we've been following, the John who's with Jane, is the OG Tarzan. Mr. Hunt is his son, and the old man is Mr. Hunt's son, making him Tarzan's grandson, even though he looks the oldest. Now, to address the concerns I had last time, I knew what I was getting into in reading these last three issues, so I was able to take the science fiction stuff, which I did have some problems with last time, and I was just able to accept that. It did actually remind me of the fact that the original Burroughs novels were written in a time before genre was a thing in fiction. Remember, genre is a marketing construct as much as it is a literary one. For purposes of merchandising, arranging a bookstore so things that are alike are together, the idea of genres were constructed, and distinctions between adventure and science fiction, and horror and fantasy and romance were made. And so, for stories of this era, Burroughs in particular, but we've also mentioned Robert E. Howard, and he qualifies as well, and many others, what they did was write in a melange of genres because they weren't writing in a genre. John Carter in particular, because there the romance is the driving force of those stories. Front and center is John and Deja, with elements of sci-fi and adventure and fantasy thrown in. But first and foremost, you could argue, that's a romance series. Now, for Tarzan, it is usually adventure first, but romance, and then elements of fantasy and sci-fi, which were themselves not really considered distinct genres either. Those are obviously in evidence as well. And that is part of what makes these books a bit of a misfit to readers today. Obviously, there are issues of sensitivity as well in many, many ways. And I'm not going to discount those in any way. But in addition to those, the mere style of the works, part of which is this mixing of genres, I do think that also makes them tough reads today. But that's why the dimensional rifts and the longevity formula, which are both classic sci-fi things, yes, they do feel a little out of place here, but I was able, with these issues, to get over myself in terms of that and just enjoy the ride. I did not want to spoil myself by reading too far ahead in terms of the Tarzan novels, but it does seem like that Golden Lion novel that was referenced does include the long life serum that was referenced here in these stories. which does point out that Mark Wheatley was well-schooled in the Burroughs novels, and that certainly helps ground this otherwise, let's be honest, bonkers, crazy story. And here, in another interesting choice, we do have a Tarzan series in which the Burroughs novels happened. They exist. Except in this world, they're, I don't know, maybe based on a true story, quote-unquote, or maybe like based on the legend of. So I can't tell that if in the world of these comics, Tarzan is akin to the human fly or D.B. Cooper. But however that can be interpreted, I think I liked it. And one thing we never got in the Tarzan novels, at least not in the ones that I've read, was Jane's POV, certainly not for the extended periods that we have it here. So this narrative technique of Jane's journal, using her as our way in to the story and the situation, I like that. It was a good change of pace for a reader of Tarzan comics. And we get so much of her internal thoughts, her drama, what it's like being married to Tarzan, and how hard it is to be married to Tarzan. Tarzan is one of those independent guys who has a viewpoint, has priorities, the jungle, animals, the warrior ethic, and nothing really ever sways him once he's decided on something. When he has a mission, he has a mission. And Jane doesn't have every one of those same priorities, at least not to the same extent or to the same magnitude that John does, that Tarzan does here. And so it was a very interesting choice, I think, to see Tarzan's actions from the viewpoint of someone else, someone, frankly, with mixed emotions about her husband. But let me tell you, after 33 years, that's what marriage is. It's two different people forming a new society where both should thrive individually while also forging a powerful, hopefully unbreakable bond anchored in and based on mutuality, service, and unconditional love. And they have issues here. They have fights. They have disagreements. There's drama. But they are committed to each other as long as they both shall live. And as Jane points out, that could be quite a long time. Before we wrap up, I do need to cover something that appeared in issue 4. Not in the story itself, but in one of the pages that followed the end of the story. Okay, Tom, I admit I've never read the original novels. In fact, the only Tarzan I am familiar with is the DC stuff by Joe Kubert. Though I don't think this measures up to that, it is still good stuff. The writing holds your attention. I'm not sure where the story is going, but that's good. It makes me want to read more. I'm a fan of Neil Vogt's previous work on the Eagle series. He really seems to work well with Hempel. The end product is pleasing to look at. Overall, the new Malibu Tarzan is an entertaining comic and worth the cover price. I look forward to future issues and future series. Sincerely, Kirk Spencer, Putney, Georgia. Now, over the last number of years, I've exchanged a number of hashtag comic book Circle of Life care packages with my buddy Kirk Spencer of Putney, Georgia. We even met once at Heroes Con a few years back. So, of course, I had to follow up with @BigFiveArmy about this letter. So I asked him a few questions, and here are his recollections and thoughts. I started with his history as a letter hack in general. I wrote a lot of letters, but usually in spurts. I would read something that inspired me to write, and then I decide to write some others while I was at it. Let me interrupt Kirk to comment that that is pretty much my process with sending podcast feedback. Kirk had two letters published in GI Combat, which he says was his biggest thrill. And if you know Kirk at all, you know how much he loves war books. So I can definitely get that. The editor, Murray Baltanoff, was probably sorry he ever responded, as I began writing him routinely with questions about comics. The process under Boltonoff was smooth. He initially wrote me to tell me my letter was in pencil and unreadable. Write again in pen, he suggested, which I did. He wrote back to tell me my letters would appear and in what issues, 265 and 267. He ended up sending me my first copy of Comic Buyer's Guide for me to find answers to some of my basic comic questions. I mentioned to Kirk that that seemed like a great interaction and was really excellent customer service. And Kirk said yes. He didn't think he'd ever received any other advance notice of a letter being published. In terms of his total overall letter writing success, I know I had another letter printed in an indie title, The Last Generation. And I found a letter in Amazing Man special earlier this year. I think there's at least one other out there that I know about, but I'm forgetting where it was right now. Now, in the original letter, Kirk commented that he didn't have a lot of experience with Tarzan, and I asked him if that was still the case. I have watched Tarzan on screen, loved the Disney animation. Have yet to read a book, though. I did pick up some from my dermatologist's office when he was giving away some. I consider myself a Tarzan fan mostly because of Joe Kubert and DC. Kubert was the first artist I learned to recognize and seek out his other work. I believe there was a house ad for the series, which sent me on a hunt. It was a lot harder to find things pre-internet and no local comic shop. Thank the good Lord for a robust flea market, thrift store, and yard sale comic community in the 70s and 80s. That sounds awesome, Kirk. And then specifically on this series, of this issue, 28 years later, I asked first if he thought he still owned this and what he thought of it. I'm sure it's still in my collection. Malibu was doing a series of miniseries, which I really enjoyed. I think they changed artists for them, and some I liked more than others. And of course, I asked him the most important question, at least as far as this podcast is concerned. A quarter would be a bargain to me for anything from that era of Malibu. Most of my favorite titles had ended. There were no more war and westerns to pick up off the stands. The independents, they offered something different and more appealing to me than the standard monthly soap opera superheroics. I would gladly buy this book again for cover price. Well, look, I'm not going to ask Kirk or any listener to do anything that drastic. And of course, around here, we frown on that kind of talk anyway. Cover price. Yick. But I do agree with the spirit of what Kirk was getting at there. The verdict on Tarzan the Warrior, 3, 4, and 5 complete quarter bin deals. And it makes me feel even better about getting them for a dime each. Now, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but it is our hope and plan that we will be able to actually talk to Kirk on an upcoming episode of this here Quarter Bin podcast. Time will tell. Well, that wraps up my coverage of Tarzan the Warrior 3, 4, and 5, bringing episode 159 to a close. Next time, because episode 60... should fall in early November, hopefully on or very near the 11th. It'll be a war book for hashtag War Comics Month. We're going to be looking at P.T. Boat Skipper Captain Storm, number 17, from DC Comics, cover dated January-February 1967. So join us for that episode. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode, Tarzan, having letters published in comics, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
Oh. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
Professor!